puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
Time for Abandoned Manitoba with Gordon Goldsberg. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, Nadia.
So what are we talking about this week?
Well, our museums are filled with items that are no longer used, maybe because they've been replaced by something better, or sometimes they're no longer needed for the purpose for which they were first created. A few weeks ago, I asked listeners to suggest a few obsolete items. And the response, oh, wow, it was overwhelming. We're going to discuss a few of them today and probably others in a future conversation.
And you had mentioned a couple of those items to get listeners thinking. Mm-hmm. One was frost shield. What's that?
Well, anyone who has driven here in winter knows how quickly windows can frost over, especially first thing in the morning before the heater has a chance to work. 2 days ago, I spent half an hour scraping the ice from my car windows. Well, frost shields were the answer. They were thin, clear plastic sheets that adhered to the inside of a car window. They didn't sit tight against the glass, though. There was a small air gap that provided just enough insulation to prevent warm, moist cabin air from condensing and freezing on the windows. People from warmer climates, well, they would have no idea what these things were for. Well, listener Janice Pregnall told me that she once heard visitors from the southern U.S. assume frost shields were bullet protectors, which I suppose, given American attitudes towards guns, was an understandable guess.
Are they no longer used?
Mostly they're no longer used. Modern window defrosters in cars, I think, do a job well enough that we don't need frost shields. But, you know, my friend Christian Cassidy has researched the whole topic of frost shields. And in fact, he knows that the first of them began to appear in Manitoba 100 years ago. I was flabbergasted. I didn't think it was anywhere close to that. But yeah, during the winter of 1926-1927, that's when they first began to be used. But what may surprise our listeners, as it did me, is that as recently as 2014, just a little over a dozen years ago, Manitoba's Highway Traffic Act still required frost shields on the front windshield. Who put them on the front windshield? Nobody that I know. On the driver's side windows and on the rear windows, for the entire period from the 1st of November to the 31st of March. Now, they aren't required anymore. I've looked at the most recent version of the act and they've been dropped. I think they're just realizing, I guess, that you really don't need them anymore. The defrosters are good enough. But of course, there are still cars on the road that date back from the days when they were needed. So I'm assuming you could still buy frost shields. I've never seen them in the stores, but then again, I've never really looked.
Now, you also mentioned toe rubbers.
Mm-hmm.
What are they?
Well, they're a shoe-shaped piece of stretchy rubber that snapped onto the bottom of your shoes. And especially this was in winter. And the idea was to protect the shoes from moisture, but also to give them better grip. Now, in my experience, and everyone I've talked to has said the same thing, toe rubbers were worn exclusively by men. And I don't recall ever seeing women wearing them, but, you know, I shouldn't say never because, you know, I'm sure I'm going to hear from a listener now that says, oh, no, I wore them too. But it's interesting. Listener Evelyn Ward, who first contacted me about this whole topic, said there were so many men that wore them in the 1950s and 60s that her father, who wore them, put a colored sticker inside his pair so that when he was in church and went home afterwards, he could find them because there was such a huge pile. And today, you're hard-pressed to ever see them.
And why are they no longer used?
Well, they made sense, I think, when shoes had slippery leather soles. In other words, they didn't have very good grip, and so the toe rubbers provided that kind of grip. And, well, now, of course, shoes mostly have rubber or synthetic soles, and so they're grippier. They're not, you know, you don't need toe rubbers as much. It's also been said, and I'm not sure how much I agree with this, but they said that as infrastructure improved, as we had things like sidewalks and paved roads, as they became common, well, there were fewer ways for the nice leather shoes. Because, of course, you want to keep your shoes looking nice. There are fewer reasons for them to get soaked or muddy in ways that the toe rubber would protect against. But, you know, toe rubbers have not vanished entirely, just like, I guess, frost shields. Because actually, a few weeks ago, I was giving a presentation at a seniors group in a church here in Winnipeg. And afterwards, one of the attendees came up to me and proudly showed me that he was still wearing a pair of toe rubbers.
So those were some obsolete items that you had off the top of your head. Mm-hmm. What about listeners? What did they tell you about?
I heard from, among other people, listener Randy McDonald, who, by the way, has a terrific sense of humor. One of the things that he told me about things that had kind of gone the way of the dodo is manners. And I'm not sure that's quite true, but it's a funny line. It's the same. And he remembered the friction fit lids that were used on many product containers, things like cocoa cans. I remember those for sure. Jam pails, cans of Rogers Golden Syrup, if you remember that stuff. And they sealed well. And once those cans were empty, the cans were perfectly good. And they became all kinds of things. Piggy banks, bolt and nut storage bins, sewing kits, lunch pails. Yeah, I remember kids when I went to elementary school bringing their lunch in an old jam pail. In a follow-up email, Randy mentioned rum and butter flavored lifesavers. Does anybody remember those? I do. And he believes that they were discontinued so people would not think they were consuming alcohol when they ate candy. And I don't think there was ever any alcohol in them, but, you know, the flavor of rum, at least, I guess, was what you're getting at. And he also noted that while wagon wheels are still a thing, you know, those chocolate-covered mm-hmm. confections, he says they should now be called wagon hubs, thanks to shrinkflation. One of the more intriguing obsolete foods that really got me thinking, and I went down a rabbit hole on this one, came from listener Laurel Sargenson. She remembers when a package of margarine came with a small packet of food coloring. And this, surprisingly, was thanks to Newfoundlanders.
So let's go down that rabbit hole now.
Okay.
What's the story behind that?
Well, of course, Newfoundland joined Confederation in 1949. It became Canada's 10th province. And one of the things that had to happen, and I never really thought much about this, is they had to reconcile the differences between Newfoundland's laws and those of the rest of Canada. One major difference entailed margarine. Now, unless you don't know what margarine is, I'm sure everybody does, but let's just recap. Of course, it's seen as a substitute for butter, and in its natural state, margarine is a pearly white mixture of oil and water, similar to lard, if you ever have seen that kind of stuff. But it can be made yellow with coloring agents when you put dye in it to make it yellow. In Newfoundland, margarine made from fish and seal oil was plentiful, and it sold for about half the price of butter. So, of course, it was highly popular. Meanwhile, in Canada, margarine was banned. And you think, why? Well, I think it was largely a measure to protect the dairy industry. Because, of course, the margarine being so much cheaper, people might go that way. And, well, you wanted to make sure people had a motive to buy butter. So if you couldn't buy margarine, well, then you had a reason. That ban was lifted only briefly between 1917 and 1923. And this was because during the First World War, there were severe butter shortages as most of the butter was sent overseas to the fighting forces. And it was only, say, 1923 that they reimposed the ban on margarine.
So Newfoundlanders could have margarine, but Canadians could not?
That's right. In 1948, you know, the year before Newfoundland joined Confederation, the Supreme Court of Canada, imagine that they weighed in on this whole matter. Like, it seems like a, you know, waste of their precious legal resources, but they weighed in on this matter. They lifted the national margarine ban, but they basically kicked it down to the provinces. They said provinces could decide their own restrictions. And in fact, most provinces permitted margarine to be sold, but only in its natural white or clear form, so that you could not mistake it for butter. You knew immediately when you saw it, this is not butter. Well, in the 1950s then, after the ban had been lifted, there were at least three brands of margarine being sold here in Manitoba, and it was made from vegetable oil and skim milk mixed together. And some of those brands included a little packet of food coloring, so you had a choice. You could then tint the margarine as yellow as you wanted at home, if that was your preference. You know, in the Manitoba legislature, the debate over this whole idea, over margarine sales, split along urban-rural lines. You know, the urban residents, well, they loved yellow-tinted margarine because, of course, it was cheap. While the rural folks, I think especially the ones on the farm, well, they just saw it as an affront to butter, to have this thing that was not even close to butter looking like butter. It was just going to cause confusion, and they were against it. Well, they had a compromise that when the legislature allowed margarine sold in Manitoba to be a, quote, pale yellow color. And I think the idea was to make it not quite butter looking, but enough that some people at least could be tricked. And then this is likely what our listener remembered, that margarine sold from the 1950s onwards. And I wasn't able to determine when they stopped doing it, when they started just adding it already at the factory. They came with a little packet of yellow food coloring. You know, so there you have it. Several obsolete items that older generations know well, but which are complete mysteries to younger ones. And by the way, if anyone has more suggestions on other items, do let me know. And we will come back to this in a future conversation.
That was my favorite abandoned Manitoba rabbit hole. Thank you to listener Laurel for that one. Really enjoyed that. Gordon, what's up for next week?
Well, you know, when I give public presentations, I'm often asked what my travels around Manitoba in search of history are really like. And people say things like, oh, I would like to drive along with you. Well, I only have room for like one or two people in my car, so that would be a limiting factor, I think. But 2 weeks ago, I spent a wonderful day exploring the area north of Riding Mountain National Park. And next week, I'm going to give our listeners a taste of what it would be like to travel with me. I'm going to talk about the places I visited in the vicinity of Grandview and what I saw at each one of those spots.
Now people get the chance to travel
virtually
with Gordon. Exactly.
That's right. And if they want to come with me physically, well, I'm not adverse to that. You know, I often lament that it's kind of a lonely existence because, you know, there's so much lovely stuff I see, but I don't get to share it with anyone.
You need to rent a minivan.
Yeah, that's
or a bus,
my baby. Who knows?
Exactly. Thank you, Gordon.
Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.